And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the race for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate is very hotly contested. I'll speak with Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks about why she thinks she is best suited to carry her party's mantle in November. That's on the way tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, I'm speaking with two local authors whose new books are based in Baltimore. My next guest is Antje Rauwerde. They teach British and postcolonial literature at Goucher College. Their new novel takes place in and around Govan's, along the York Road corridor in North Baltimore. And at the outset of the story, the book's protagonists, Danny and Em, know each other only in passing. But as their connection deepens, we learn about their pasts and what they've lost and how they have coped with those losses. Antje Rauwerde joins me here in Studio A. It's great to meet you.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the book, which I really enjoyed. Let's talk about the place. Let's talk about why Govan's in particular, why Baltimore in general and Govan's in particular is where you decided to set this.
So as you were talking with Judith in the last half hour, I'm not from here. So writing about where I lived was a way of trying to understand it, trying to get to know it. And at the time that I started writing this, I was living on a very short half-block street called Kernwood Avenue, and it's really close to the intersection of York and Cold Spring. Both of those are busy thoroughfares, lots of traffic, lots of garbage, lots of dust, lots of yelling all times of day and night. And I have dogs, like Em.
Yeah, Em walks her dogs in this book, right?
I don't have everything in common with Em, but the dog walking I do. And I fell in love with a hillside. If you cut down from York Road and head east on Radnor, there's this beautiful flank of a hillside. It's got row houses on it now, tiny front yards, tiny backyards. It's not especially scenic, except it's this lovely geography down to what was an old river valley. And it ends up on Alhambra Avenue, which is kind of broken up into a couple of pieces. But that piece of Alhambra runs along what was a river valley, and there are old houses there, but they sit on kind of big plots of land. There are a couple of abandoned lots there where plants have just run riot. And I realized on my dog walks that those riotous empty lots were just a real reprieve from the cityness of it all. And I mean, they're weeds. It's run over with weeds and like volunteer trees and it's not Sherwood Gardens, it's not groomed or scenic, but it was fresh air, and it was like nature claiming the place back. And it made me think about what had been there before the houses were there and before the row houses were there. And even in its very contemporary kind of ugliness, it's beautiful.
So, yeah. So it's actually the physical visual effect that this little bit of nature had on you led you to write the novel.
Yeah.
And nature, in fact, is almost a character in this book because there are little interludes where we hear not just from the main characters, whose names are Danny and Em, but we hear from nature.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting device. How did you come about that?
Well, I had the two characters, and this is a very writer problem. It's like they were strangers to each other, and I needed to manipulate their interaction. There are all kinds of ways you can do that, and
So Em is walking her dogs.
Em is walking her dogs.
Danny's on the porch, you know, and they say hi and stuff, but they don't know each other.
Right, so how do you get past hi, right? How do you get past, hey, how's it going? So I decided to make the place itself have agency so that there's a problem in both of those characters' lives, and it's like the place itself feels uneasy because of the problems, and so is forcing those characters into these alignments so that they encounter each other to try and resolve some issues. And I gave nature a voice, which is a little woo-woo. It's a little out there. But it was really...
Woo-woo, is that a literary term? You're a literary professor.
Yes, very technical, yes.
Well, let's hear an example of that. This is from the novel Slow Time, my guest Antje Rauwerde, reading. This chapter is called The Moon-Kissed Children.
Impact. A sudden blow. An adult voice. A man yelling. A boy cries, and then white blonde in the spring moonlight, he stumbles into the yard. He runs to its furthest corner and curls up in the hollow, weeping, his tears, snot, saliva running into my soil. At the front of the house, a door slams, then a car chokes itself alive and leaves into the dark night. Inside the Fieldstone house, a woman sleeps too soundly through all this, falling down into her self-induced, pill-addled dreams. A baby starts to cry inside, wailing like a lost cub, wailing on into the night for all the breezes long, for as long as a cloud to cross the night sky all the way from the moon to the horizon. Finally, the white blonde boy stiffens under the moonlight, wipes his muddy tears on his pajama sleeve, gets up and goes inside. He returns with a small girl baby, his white blonde hair, her gray eyes in the moonlight. He curls in the hollow again, the baby nestled against his belly, cooing and happy as he dandles his fingers over her face for her to see. Then both sleep, these pale cubs curled in the palm of my hollow, under the clear spring moon, the scent of night lavender around them. When the fox trots along the alley, she catches in the wind the scent of human close by and pauses, confused. She slinks closer, slides through the fence to see them. She stands on the lip of the hollow and sees the child and the baby, asleep as if two kits in a den, the baby girl sucking gently on the boy child's smallest finger.
And, you know, this is not a, what's it called, third-person omnipotent, description, you know, coming from the sky. This is actually coming from the place where these two young kids are cuddled up with each other.
Yeah. I tried to write from below. So as you mentioned, I teach at Goucher College and I teach contemporary international fiction. And in Aboriginal Australian culture, time is a completely different perspective. And sometimes that gets represented as though it's from above. And I wanted to see what happened if you did something like that from below. Like, could you write from the dirt up, from like volcanoes up? So that's part of nature's voice. It is a limited perspective. It's not omniscient, and it's coming from below.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of times there are certain parts of York Road, anybody who's familiar with this area of town, that aren't, you know, at all naturally beautiful or anything. It's not like nature, as you say, it's not like Sherwood Gardens, which is all, you know, manicured, or even, you know, Oregon Ridge or something, which is, you know, really, when you think about environment, that's kinds of the kinds of places you tend to think about. So that's an interesting take that, you know, the nature of York Road could have a voice, you know?
I'm glad you noticed that. Nature's still there, right? Like, even now you drive down York Road and there are tire repair shops and gas stations and things like that, and they'll have, like, sagging gutters, and in the gutters, things are growing. So it's, you know, and there are birds there, and so... Yeah, we've paved over everything and, like, stank it up with gasoline fumes and all of that, and the plants are still fighting back. So I wanted to write about that.
And it also is a book about these converging stories, the story of Em and the story of Danny. So we learn about their, you know, younger lives. We learn about trauma that they've endured. And unlike Judith's book that we were talking about in the first half of the show, which is siblings, these are strangers. And that's an interesting palette for a writer to fool with, because it could go anywhere.
It could go anywhere. It's a tricky palette when you are a white writer and you're going across race lines, which Em is white, Danny's black. So... It's a fraught decision to make. What brought me there was an acquaintance I had who lived on Cold Spring, whose name was Donald. So he's kind of loosely a referent. He's passed away, so Donald, rest in peace. Who I got to know a little bit, and getting to know him, there wasn't that, you know, when you meet a complete stranger, there's often a moment of like sizing each other up, right? So you say the polite things, but you're sort of looking at each other's clothes and how you carry, you know, it's like, okay, well, who are they and where do they fit in social hierarchy and where do they fit in the world and how would they fit relative to me? Donald was amazing because you kind of entered right into a conversation with him as though there was none of that sizing up happening.
Just very open.
Very open, very natural in a way, which I think is difficult for us to access socially sometimes as humans, especially across racial lines. So I was really inspired by the way in which he was friendly. Friendly sounds like a kind of cliche. But yeah, he was kind of in the back of my mind thinking about the interaction of these two characters.
My guest is Antje Rauwerde. We're talking about their latest book. It's a novel. It's called Slow Time. And we'll have more with Antje Rauwerde on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Antje Rauwerde. Their new book is called Slow Time. And Antje, this book has a couple of characters who have not spent their whole lives in Baltimore. They've been all around, not unlike you. What's your background? You've lived in all sorts of different and disparate places. You've been here in Baltimore for quite a while, but before that, you were a wandering person.
Yeah, that's my academic life is on people who have had that kind of wandering background. Canadian by passport, but my father was Dutch, but he was born in Indonesia. My mother was German. I grew up in Calgary, in Singapore, back in Calgary, in North Wales, Shropshire in England, Ghana, and Dallas. So my father was
Of course, Dallas.
My father was a geologist, and he wound up working as a consultant for a petrochemical company. Kind of oil-based trajectory.
So many of these stops were not particularly long. You were there for just, you know, a little while?
Singapore was 8 years, 2 years in North Wales, 2 years in England, only a year in Dallas. Singapore was probably the longest stint.
Mm-hmm. And so you were always the new kid, right?
Yeah.
In the schools.
Yep.
What was that? Did you find that a shaping, informing experience?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so Singapore, I was actually the older kid because most expat contracts at the time were like a year or 2 years. So to be in Singapore for 7 or 8, you're actually an old hand. I think you miss something in terms of developing skills for like long-term friendships, because friendships are cyclical then. And I have people.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, if someone asks you, where are you from? You say, you know, Canadian by passport.
Yes.
Which is interesting, which is true, of course.
Right.
But I moved 7 times before I went to college, only in the United States, but all around those. I've lived in Dallas for 9 months.
Okay.
when I was in the second grade, so I don't know anything about Dallas. But, you know, when people say, where are you from? I've lived in Baltimore now for 43 years, so I think I'm from here.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. Why did you move around?
My dad got transferred. Okay. He was in a job that they just, you know, they said, okay, you don't live here anymore, you live there. And we had five kids, and they didn't care one hoot about that. And they just said, all right, we're moving you. So it was fine, you know, it was fine. But I don't regret it, and I also don't have friends in all of those places anymore. I
mean, right.
Because, you know, you're a little kid when you move, or at least I was.
Yeah.
But I just, is that question for you important? You know, where are you from? And is it important for the characters in this book, Danny and Em?
Well, it's interesting. So to get academic-y for a moment, there's a term for, like, third culture kids. So people who have been, so you're, if you're a third culture kid, your passport nation would be your first culture. The host country, so for example, that might have been Singapore, would be a second culture. But I was never Singaporean. So the third culture is like fellow displaced people, other expats, other people who are living in a dislocated way. And the joke among third culture kids is that that's the most impossible question to ask anybody, like, where are you from? It's like, bah, how much time do you have? Right? Like, or what's the context? Why do you need to know?
Yeah. Does it matter?
And does it matter? But slow time is kind of a fantasy of what if you were really from somewhere, right? Like, what if the place really claimed you as like, these are my residents, these are of me. So there's a little bit of like fantastical wish fulfillment there, I think, about like, what if you really, in ways that were far beyond human understanding, like what if you really belonged in a spot?
Yeah, because these two characters also are still attached to the homes that their parents had.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just them, it's the childhood places where they literally grew up. And, you know, for somebody who moved around a lot, we have no notion of, you know, the same bedroom for, you know, 25 years or 18 years before you go to college or something.
Right. It's funny that you pick up on that. My parents for a long time lived in Vancouver. So after all of that moving around, they retired to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing this book, my father passed away and my mother moved out of the house that they'd been in for about 10 years, which was in our family's terms, that's a long time.
That's a lifetime, right.
So I guess I hadn't thought about the attachments to houses, but I guess maybe I was processing a little bit of that, thinking about the attachments to houses. I had a neighbor in Radnor-Winston just ask me the other day if I grew up on Kernwood Avenue, which I didn't. But I thought, good, at least something in the fiction went right if they can ask that question. It's like, yes, I'm glad you think that I might have. Good, I was persuasive.
So third culture writers is something that you study
as an academic. Yeah.
What is it about that, you know, that expat thing? It's like expat squared when you're third culture. You know, I never heard that term before even. I mean, that's is there a distinguishing characteristic to the kind of writing, the subject matter, et cetera?
I read a whole book about that, Tom. We can talk about that another time.
I haven't read that one. Sorry. I read your novel. I haven't read that one.
I think there are a couple. And it depends a little bit why people moved around. When I embarked on the academic book that studied that, I thought I would be reading all of this. It's like, okay, this is going to feel great for me because I'm reading all of these books that are about people who've moved around like I have. It's going to be wonderful. And it turned out I was reading book after book after book that was loosely child abuse. And even you said, like, your parents didn't care, like, there were five of you, and it was like, well, it wasn't a consideration.
No, we had to eat. The company said, you know, you don't work here anymore, you work there. And,
right.
And Dad said, okay.
So they can't really weigh the fact that you have to leave behind your friends in grade one, or that, you know, you're going to lose contact with the favorite park, or, you know, that a pet has to stay behind, or... So what comes up, so... across like people who were dislocated because of parents' military careers or parents' missionary careers or diplomatic careers or commercial careers over and over again, is themes of children feeling this tremendous grief because your whole world changes. You lose all your friends. Often you lose connections with extended family. And the parents don't really see it.
Did you feel that? Because I didn't. I mean, for whatever reason. I mean, it always seemed to me, you know, this is kind of a place, you know, this is a new opportunity to reinvent myself.
That's how Danny feels.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I related to Danny. And he was a military brat.
He was a military brat.
And, you know, and it was certainly very, and he's 50 years old, you know, so he's not a kid.
Yeah.
He's had time to, you know, let these things sink into his DNA.
I think it can be both, right? But certainly, Danny, and there's a part of the book where he describes like approaching it strategically as an opportunity. It's like, okay, so every time I move to a new airbase, I can be an even friendlier kid and I can be even better at math and just kind of recreate himself a little bit more with each dislocation. He really uses it well.
Because he plays against stereotype in a lot of ways, and you know have invented him along those lines, and that's important. So it's not just the place that he's from, or the experiences he's had, but it's his general impulse in life,
you know,
to invent himself, to keep reinventing himself.
And partly he's reinventing himself because he has this terrible guilt over something that happened when he was very young, and so he's compensating or like trying to, he never calls it karma, but like almost trying to make a deal with the world, right? Like, okay, I did that thing that is probably terrible, so how can I continue to make recompense for it?
And M is the one that sort of animates the story because it's her curiosity, it's her interest in, you know, sort of what his story is and what the story of this house is and
she
all
that.
She has
these weird dreams too, and she realizes that there's something to do with the house. So it's like she doesn't really know, but it's like this compulsion to figure out what's going on with the house because she feels this connection that's kind of coming to her through dreams.
And it's interesting because, again, there's the beauty of disorder. It seems to be high on the list in this book rather than the beauty of order. We think of beauty in symmetrical terms and you know, clean, you know, well-polished terms. But there's a wildness to the landscape of this book and even to the approach with nature being a you know, a character. It's an interesting take.
I like decay. Like I like my history to show as like things that are where you can see the decay. I find that beautiful.
It's all over this book. The book is called Slow Time. The author is Antje Rauwerda, and she'll be speaking about the book with the author Marion Crotty on Thursday night at the Ivy Bookshop, and that event begins at 6:00. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate Angela Alsobrooks will join me to talk about her vision for Maryland and for the country. And coming up now, it's Fresh Air. That's happening after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast and checking us out on the WYPR app. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.